Hi everybody, today is Wednesday, August 6, 2025, and our friend Leith Maroof is back with us. Welcome back, Leith.
Great to be with you, Nima.
Yeah, we couldn't talk last week because of what has happened to you in Lebanon. Could you let us know what has happened, Leith? What was the problem with you?
Yeah, I mean, it's not fully clear, but somebody must have been really pissed off about our coverage. What I understand is that, at least partially, we're still trying to figure out fully the information, but that, you know, we were going down to Mais el Jabal to do a night report. Mais el Jabal village is right on the border with occupied Palestine. It's in a part of the Lebanese territory that is like a peninsula inside Palestine. So on all sides, three sides of it, there's Israeli military bases. We're trying to cover the nightly attacks that were happening on the south. And we were informed that the Israeli military basically called the UNIFIL, and the Israeli called also the Lebanese military intelligence and informed them that they're basically pissed off at us and they may be attacking us. So at that point, we were surrounded as we were entering the village by youth on motorcycles, and eventually we were taken to the military intelligence of Lebanon, and I was detained for 3 days in various barracks, including the main military intelligence barracks outside Beirut. I was questioned every day, and my phone was confiscated, and they pulled out the information. I was questioned about all my contacts inside occupied Palestine. It's mainly the people that I trained over the last 30 years doing radio work and television work, including our journalists that were in the West Bank bringing us the reports during this Aqsa flood. And there was a nice public campaign started by Hadi Hatit, my partner in crime, the guy that's always behind the camera when we're filming. And thousands of people called the Canadian embassy in Beirut and sent their emails. Tens of thousands of posts were made, and that pressured the Canadian government to send the secretary or the consul general of the embassy, who visited me, and that led to my release that day. You know, so I thank everybody that stood for my freedom and, you know, made public statements. I would want to say also that I wasn't tortured or physically harmed. Obviously, it's not a comfortable thing to be detained and questioned, but the Lebanese military intelligence didn't breach any laws. Having said that, it's also important to note that I became the longest held journalist in Lebanon since the end of the civil war in 1990, which is not a good thing. A lot of journalists here, journalist associations, also complain to the government and have made public statements in support of my freedom. And eventually I was released with no charges or conditions. And the Lebanese military intelligence invited me to their offices after, apologized for the mistakes that were done, and provided me with permits to cover everything in the country. I'm now able to move without having anybody harass me in any way. So hopefully this pound of flesh that I gave is going to bring better content on Free Palestine TV.
Great. And I really suggest those people who are watching us to follow Leith, he's doing a very important and crucial work there and reporting on the ground, and providing us with information. No one else is able to do that. Leith, here is what we heard from Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem. He warns Israel, he warns of Israeli collapse within hours if all-out war erupts. We know that they're trying to put a lot of pressure on Hezbollah in Lebanon. And the main tool of putting pressure on them is the new government in Lebanon. And how do the people feel about it in Lebanon, the way that they're trying to somehow limit and, I don't know, corner Hezbollah?
Yeah, the American envoy of Trump, Barak, came last week, and along with him, the Saudi ambassador to Beirut. And they basically gave an ultimatum to the Lebanese government to disarm Hezbollah, or that war will be back on the country. The ultimatum is broken up to two stages, 15 days where Hezbollah has to hand over all its medium and personal weapons, including hand grenades. And the next stage, 60 days after that, everything should be, including the manufacturing capabilities of drones and what have you, should be handed over. And the speech by Sayyid Naim al-Qassem, the new Secretary General of Hezbollah yesterday, was very confrontational. He said Hezbollah will not be handing anything over, and until the Lebanese government is able to defend Lebanon and put a plan of national defense that strengthens the military to a level that it can defend itself from Israeli occupation and attacks, there will be no handing over of Hezbollah's weapons. There's been demonstrations over the last 2 days across Lebanon of support for Hezbollah. We've heard statements from a lot of the political parties also, including the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, the Amal movement, communists and others that are all standing by Hezbollah. So I don't know what the Lebanese military and the Lebanese government can do to appease, the Americans and the Israelis. But yesterday there was a cabinet meeting for the Lebanese government, and they voted to, have the Lebanese military provide them with a plan to disarm Hezbollah within the next, 4 months. And this is very dangerous because the Lebanese military is, overwhelmingly, the majority of the soldiers are from the Shia community. And a lot of the officers are very patriotic, including the current head of the Lebanese military. And so a attempt to have the Lebanese military confront Hezbollah will either lead to mutiny within the military and or a civil war where we're back to basically 1970s and 1980s here, when Americans and the Israelis were using local agents to confront any resistance. And I don't know what will happen in the next few weeks as the pressure mounts up from the Zionists and the Americans. There's very big possibilities of attacks by HTS from Syria and the Zionist simultaneously. But I think this time, if there is a full-out war again, Hezbollah will not be, limiting its response. You remember previously in the first phase of this war, Hezbollah was just defending its territory of Lebanon and managed to defeat the Israelis and not allow them to occupy one inch of the country until the ceasefire happened and the Lebanese military failed to, and the Lebanese government failed to protect the south of Lebanon and force the Israelis to respect the conditions of the ceasefire. And this is something else. The Americans have said openly that they will not guarantee any ceasefire with the Zionist colony, even if Hezbollah is totally disarmed. The U.S. will not be intervening if there's any attack on Lebanon by the Zionists.
What is the size of Lebanese army, and how trained, how prepared are they to defend Lebanon if something happens?
Yeah, the Lebanese army is, you know, just under 200,000 members, but it's very lightly armed. In fact, if we look at the armaments of the Israeli military, Lebanese military, sorry, it's clear that the Americans have only allowed the Lebanese military to have equipment that can guarantee internal control of the country. So the Lebanese military doesn't have any offensive capabilities or defensive capabilities against an invading force. So the Americans have only allowed the Lebanese military to be armed as if it's an internal police force that could confront internal militias. And therefore, the Lebanese military doesn't have any air forces, has Cessna planes. It doesn't have any air defenses, doesn't have radars, it doesn't have tanks. It has APCs. It doesn't have howitzers, long-range howitzers. It has, you know, Katyusha missiles. So these are all weapons that are usually in the hands of militias, not in the hands of a national army that can actually defend its territory. And the last time HTS or Wahhabi death squads attacked Lebanon, you know, we saw in both cases of when Al-Qaeda, ISIS, attacked Lebanon during the Syria war and invaded the Qalamun Mountains, the Lebanese military was defeated resoundly and very fast, and lost hundreds of soldiers that were slaughtered on television by ISIS. And it was Hezbollah, with the help of the Syrian military, that at the time when the Syrian military was not in the hands of the United States, that defeated ISIS and Al-Qaeda in the Qalamun Mountains on the borders between Lebanon and Syria and liberated the land. Similarly, after the fall of the Assad government in Damascus, HTS attempted to invade from the north of Lebanon, and the Lebanese military just evaporated. And it fell, the defense of Lebanon fell on the hands, on the backs of the tribes in the north of Lebanon, who fought valiantly and defeated HTS and destroyed all their columns that were advancing on the Biqa Valley. So again, we can see that the Lebanese military is incapable of confronting militias like HTS or Al-Qaeda or ISIS. So I don't think they'll be able to confront the Hezbollah and other resistance groups in the country.
Last time Israel wanted invaded Lebanon and put troops underground after the assassination of Hezbollah leaders, they've been defeated. That's why they've asked for a ceasefire, in my opinion. And it seems that somehow they're trying to manage the situation differently, as though they're preparing the government in Lebanon to somehow politically attack Hezbollah. If something happens between Hezbollah and the government and the army of Lebanon, and that would be hugely beneficial for Israelis to attack Lebanon again. Is that the case? Does the people, I don't know, do the people feel about it? How do the people feel about it? And how they can, because after all, you have to understand that there we can say that the situation between Hezbollah and the government in Lebanon is somehow, there are a lot of challenges between the two parties. But after all, what is important is how to defend Lebanon. Is there any sort of grand strategy going toward that objective, if that would be the case?
You know, the current prime minister, Salam, has barely lived in Lebanon most of his life. His immediate family is not in the country. And he doesn't belong to any political party. You know, he was brought in by the United States from his position as head of the ICJ to govern. So he has no loyalties to any sectors of society here, and he has nothing to lose if something bad happens to the country. And that's a dangerous situation, to have somebody who leads the country who has nobody to answer to, neither a party, a movement, a sector of society, or even a family to answer for their safety. And this is what's bringing us these stupid positions from the government. And I think there is a little bit of a difference between the President Aoun and the Prime Minister Salam on these issues. And because Aoun used to be the head of the Lebanese military and has lived all his life here, he's not a dual citizen, and he is, you know, he comes from a village in the south of Lebanon that was attacked by the Israelis. So there is, even if, you know, Aoun as a president wanted to accommodate the United States and the Saudis and the Israelis, he has a whole sectors of society that he has to answer to. And therefore, after they put him in the position of president and he was in power, you could see that his language changed to much more supportive of Lebanese territory integrity and the safety of the Lebanese people. So the attempt by Salame yesterday to pass, which he had succeeded, pass this resolution at the cabinet, was in direct challenge to the president. So we're starting to see problems rising within even the government that the United States managed to install with the president and the prime minister. And I look at, you know, the you can look on Twitter. Everybody could, even if you don't read Arabic, you should press the translate button. But the vast majority of Lebanese people, no matter what their sect is, are against the handing over of weapons of Hezbollah or the disarmament of the resistance. Even the leader of the Kata'ib party from the Jumayl dynasty. Al-Kata'ib party is a Christian supremacist party that was part of the civil war, killings of Palestinians. And the father of the current leader of the Al-Kata'ib party was the prime minister appointed by Israel after occupying Beirut in 1982. He came basically on top of an Israeli tank, and he was assassinated by the Syrian military and the resistance in Lebanon. This guy, who has all this history of collaboration with the West, when asked a few days ago about disarming Hezbollah, he said, it is not the time to talk about that. Look at what's happening to the Christian communities in Syria, the Druze, the Shia, and Alawites. If Hezbollah hands over their weapons right now, we're going to be slaughtered. So even within the most, you know, controlled sectors of society here, let's say the Maronites that are more leaning towards Western, you know, support, we have this split. The majority of the Christian Maronites in Lebanon have watched the horrors in Syria and are now arming themselves also. There is a rapid, you know, arming of much of society in Lebanon. The Druze, the Shia, the Alawites, the Christians are all arming themselves to the teeth, buying personal weapons, those hand grenades that Barak, the envoy of Trump once, are now everywhere. Every house has now hand grenades. And this is because everybody understands that if you're found without weapons now, not only will you be killed, but your whole family will be raped. And, you know, videos of that will be sent on the internet by, you know, Wahhabi death squads and or Israeli invaders. So there's no way the Lebanese military, I think, will confront Hezbollah and the other resistance factions. And we'll see how Salam will attempt over the next few weeks to force the military to come under his control. And I don't think he's going to be successful.
I think what has happened between Hezbollah and the government in Lebanon, I'm not talking about the new government, the people who are working for the government in Lebanon, you remember then they were somehow, how could they achieve the assassination of these leaders of Hezbollah, the commanders of Hezbollah? You remember that they communicated with them through the government in Lebanon, and they gave them some sort of calmness that they want to reach something politically and all of that. They prepared that. They used the government in Lebanon to assassinate the leader of Hezbollah, Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, and the commanders. So I think if there is something to be fixed is on the part of the government in Lebanon, they have to achieve that. But I don't see they're trying to do that. They're trying to somehow go against Hezbollah instead of being more logic, being more, you know, it doesn't make sense. I don't know how can they talk about defending Lebanon when people see what was the outcome of their policy so far.
Yeah, I mean, look, much of the government jobs in Lebanon are reserved by sect and party. So we don't have a national, you know, public servants that are appointed because of their skills and their loyalty to the country. Every time there is a wave of jobs openings, they are divided by sects and then handed over by party, you know. So it's all nepotism kind of situation. This is why there's very little patriotic sentiment within the public service sector here in Lebanon. And also everything is infiltrated. Not only is the enemy infiltrating the public service in Lebanon, but also even the resistance itself. You know, the resistance has people in every ministry. The resistance has people inside the military. This minimizes the ability of those who want to corner Hezbollah to achieve their goals. It's very hard for them to hide their plans. In terms of the targeting of Hezbollah's leadership during the war, we need to know two things. One is that this is a very small country. It's just 4 million citizens, and the territory is small. And Israel had, between 2006 and 2023, you know, 20, you know, almost 20 years, 18 years, to collect as much information as possible, right? The movement of everybody and everybody's families and everybody's cousins and wives' cousins and so forth. It's not a big achievement to be able to track all this movement, especially that Hezbollah was a legitimate political party that was, you know, and the leadership, like Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, martyr Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, were having public meetings with dignitaries coming from around the world, and or leadership of the political parties in Lebanon, or the president and the prime minister. So I don't think we can say specifically that collaborators within the Lebanese government gave information about Hezbollah. It would be ridiculous to think that over those 18 years that Israel wasn't able to map the society with AI and mass information gathering. So I wouldn't say that the Lebanese government were part of the assassination of Seyed Hassan Nasrallah. Having said that, I think we also need to note that Hezbollah itself made a few mistakes when it shifted its structures from being a rebellion militia, rebel, you know, revolutionary militia that is organized in cell formations and secrecy, into becoming a semi-military during the war in Syria, where they had to reorganize their structures and even purchase different equipment that they didn't need before, tanks and what have you, and, you know, drones and so on, which exposes the organization. Once you know there's an actual military structure, you have to know who the names are. But now we see a huge shift back again. Hezbollah is very secretive right now. There's very little information we can even get from the speeches of the new Secretary General, Naim al-Qassem, about the organization and how it has responded to the conditions since the war. The only thing that we got actually as information from yesterday's speech that nobody had before was the number of Hezbollah fighters martyred in this battle, which is now we know is 5,000 Hezbollah fighters were killed in the battle and almost 15,000 injured. This is purely the fighters. This is not talking about the civilians that were killed and or fighters from other factions that were defending also Lebanon on the side of Hezbollah. And that's he said this to show that Hezbollah has sacrificed the most of all parts of society here in Lebanon to defend the country, its sovereignty, and its territorial integrity.
Yeah, the collaboration that I was mentioning, it wasn't about that the government is somehow giving information, but I was, because they were negotiating, they were used as some sort of tool to negotiate with Hezbollah, you know, to give them just the legitimizing, I would say, the negotiations between Hezbollah and the other party, that would be the United States and Israel. That's why I think the Hezbollah leadership somehow felt they can rely on what's going on, that was the problem. And I don't know if the government in Lebanon recognizes that sort of fault, that sort of problem.
Yeah, there's two things there. You know, the Hezbollah has, you know, at that point, although Hezbollah was defeating the invading force, there was mass destruction in Lebanon, and the Zionists began attacking Beirut as a whole, not only the Dahiya or the southern suburb. So Hezbollah didn't want the population that has to feel, you know, immense loss, even, you know, at that point, and maybe blame Hezbollah for it. So Hezbollah accepted the ceasefire and allowed the Lebanese military to and government to accept this ceasefire and delivered on all what the Lebanese government and the ceasefire requires, which is removing all their weapons from south of the Litani. And all to show the population, I think, that the Lebanese government will fail to deliver on its duty once Hezbollah withdraws from the south, and that the Israelis will never deliver on their own obligations under this ceasefire. And that's now very clear. The Zionists destroyed the vast majority of the villages in South Lebanon on the border after the ceasefire, while the Lebanese military just watched that happening. The Israeli military continues killing Lebanese civilians since the ceasefire. I think it's now almost 400 Lebanese civilians have been killed since the ceasefire. And the Lebanese military just sat down and watched. The Lebanese government hasn't been able to deliver on anything. So now Hezbollah is in a much, much stronger position, because the Lebanese civilians that were scared about their own life at the last stages of the war, the 66-day war here, are now seeing that it's going to be even more dangerous for their life if Hezbollah doesn't resist and hasn't the ability to resist. So there's a huge shift in public opinion because Hezbollah played this smartly. And now when Hezbollah resists again, there's going to be much bigger sectors of society that support him, no matter what the outcome is or the cost that they will have to pay.
Laith, when it comes to Syria, we know that Turkey is providing Syria, these people in Syria, with the gas and oil coming from Azerbaijan. And how do you see the situation in Syria? Is that going to, is the government, is these people who are self-declared president of Syria, is he getting somewhere with the administration, or we are going to see, we would see more chaos in Syria in the coming months? And
you know, it's so funny because Syria has its own oil and gas, which is sufficient to provide all the needs of the Syrian people, as well as even export for hard currency, you know. Prior to the global Western war on Syria that started in 2012, Syria had 24 hours electricity and was exporting electricity to Lebanon. So now to have Erdogan bring the oil of and gas of Azerbaijan and sell it to the Syrian government while the Syrian oil and gas is being looted by the United States and the Kurdish Contras that control the Northeast, exported through Turkey, where Turkey is making money out of it, this looted oil and gas, this is gangsterism at its highest form. This is not a service to Syria, what Erdogan is doing. He is stripping the Syrian society and government, whatever it is, of their last hard currency dollars that they have in their banks, okay, while their own oil and gas is making him money. And so this is ridiculous. Of course, the Wahhabi death squads led by al-Julani, controlling now Damascus, really only control the population spine of Syria between Aleppo and Damascus. The rest of the country is out of their control. The south is occupied by the Israelis. Sweida, also in the south, is independent, basically. It's autonomous. The HDS hasn't been able to defeat the Druze resistance in Sweida. The northeast is occupied by the United States and the Kurdish militias, and all this, resources are looted. The coast is, monitored and controlled by the Russians, and HTS can't do anything there without Russian approval. So what country does al-Julani control? Nothing. He controls a huge population that has zero resources because all the resources of the country are in the edges. I don't think the control of al-Julani is going to last long. We have indications that even his handlers, like in Israel and or in Turkey, don't see his ability to deliver on their goals in the country. So we may see either internal fighting between the various Wahhabi death squads that are now under the auspices of the Damascus government over who can provide a better service to the masters in Tel Aviv or in Istanbul. We will see a continued rise of resistance, maybe a return to resistance in the coast, all because these Wahhabi death squads don't represent anybody. Their cult doesn't resemble even the vast majority of Sunni sentiments in the country. Sunnis here in Syria and Lebanon and are mainly Sufi, meaning mystic, from the Sufi schools of Sunnism, not you know, extremist as the Wahhabis are, and this religious elite in the Sunni population here and the financial elite within the Sunni population, they will not accept a rule by such fanatics.
Pentagon confirmed the closure of three bases in Syria, and two of them is in the southern part of Syria and one of them is the northeast of Syria. We know that these, you mentioned about the oil Syria, and the United States was controlling that part of Syria that is providing, that can provide Syria with energy. Is that still the case? Is that in the hand of the United States? That's why Turkey is not, I don't know if there were some sort of negotiation talks between Al-Jolani and the government in Turkey, considering what's going on with the energy, with the case of energy in Syria. Who's controlling that as we talk?
Yeah, the oil and gas of Deir ez-Zor and Hasaka is mainly being looted by the Kurdish Contras, and convoys of this oil and gas are protected by American troops as they are sent through the border to Turkey. It's Erdogan's son and his son-in-law that have companies buying this oil and gas in collaboration with Israeli businessmen. And then it's funneled to the port of Iskenderun on the corner of the Mediterranean, and then shipped to Israel. So everybody in this chain gets a cut from this money. You have the Kurdish Contras that that's their main source of wealth right now. The American government pays for all its military costs in Syria from this, as well as all the CIA with all their black operations are funded through this looted oil and gas. And Erdogan's son and son-in-law also make tons of money from this. And finally, Israel gets dirt cheap oil and gas that is looted from Syria with no like traces of the origin, And so until those who are making money from the looting of Syria's oil and gas, until that looting becomes not worth it financially, and or is costing them through loss of life and attacks and whatever, what have you, this will continue. I mean, it's been now 15 years since the destruction of Libya, and this is the richest country in Africa, was the richest country in Africa with the hugest reserve of oil and gas. Does anybody know where Libya's oil and gas is going? Nobody cares. 15 years down the road, the Libyan people have no say in their oil and gas and are not benefiting from the existence of their oil and gas. It's France, Italy, and the United States that are looting the oil and gas of Libya and financing their military operations through it, financing their intelligence operations through it, and also propping their collapsing economies through it.
Yeah. Eighth, we know that European countries, they're talking about they will recognize state of Palestine in September. And the situation in Gaza is not, the reports are so much, the suffering, the starvation, the killing, what's going on there, it's unbelievable, and it doesn't seem that anybody has any sort of solution to what's going on. And these governments, even in Europe, they're talking about recognizing the state of Palestine while they're providing Israel with everything they want to continue this war in Gazans. How do you find the situation there? Do you feel that even Donald Trump himself said it depends on Israel? It doesn't seem that anybody cares about putting pressure on Netanyahu in order to put an end to the conflict. On the other hand, we know the public opinion has somehow has shifted, it has totally changed during the conflict. The people know what's going on in Gaza. We had the U.S. Green Beret Colonel Anthony Angular. He came out and he said he was picturing what was going on in Gaza. Nobody was that much informed about. He was on the ground there seeing what Israelis are doing, and he's someone that Americans would believe, you know, because he's American, he was in the army of the United States. That's why I think his sort of story is resonating with the people in the United States. What is the outcome of all of this complexity that we're witnessing, considering the case of Gaza and Gazan people and the starvation? And what's your take on the new political movements forced by the public opinion?
Yeah, I mean, like the story of, you know, the retired Green Beret there is another indicator of the shift that you were mentioning in public opinion. And we know the vast majority right now of Americans, Europeans, Canadians, Australians, and those were the countries that used to support Israel before even this genocide. But now the vast majority of the citizens of those countries are against the Zionist colony, are against the genocide, and against the participation of their own countries in arming and financing and giving cover to this genocide. And so, you know, I think we're increasingly seeing how much of a shift that has happened over the last 22 months. And, you know, to have a former soldier speak in these ways, that also must be an indicator for the Western governments that things are getting dangerous, where somebody who had training carrying arms is saying, hey, this is a genocide. And maybe they're even lucky that he didn't shoot people on the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation killing zones. I mean, if I was him and I had a conscientious moment like he did, maybe I would have turned my guns on whoever is shooting around me, on the Palestinian children and civilians coming for food. So this is must have rang alarm bells, because we remember what happened in Vietnam when American soldiers were killing American officers that were giving them orders to commit war crimes, right? So that's an alarm bell of what's going to happen within American, you know, troops stationed in Israel. What's going to happen within other Western troops that are on the ground that are not being informed how many of them are. And add to it that already the militancy is growing in these populations in the West. We saw already civilians carrying arms and shooting two Israeli staff from the embassy in D.C. and killing them. We saw another civilian throwing Molotov cocktails on Zionists in Colorado that were demonstrating. And in the U.K., in Europe, in Canada, there's groups like Palestine Action that are destroying military manufacturers that are selling weapons to the Zionist colony. These are all indicators that things are getting to a boiling point, that if the Western elite do not represent the will of their people on this issue, That there will be a collapse of the social contract between these states and their populations. It's on the edge right now. And the more radical in support of the Zionist colony they are as governments, and or the more oppressive they are of their own populations that are against the genocide, the more likely that there will be a militant response from the population, especially that the majority of the population right now has lost any trust to the mass media that is controlled by the corporates and the governments, and have lost trust in the political system as a whole. We look at the United States, where the vast majority of citizens don't vote. That was before this genocide. That was before the outright collapse of credibility of government and media in the West. This is happening across, I think, all of the Western countries. And this is dangerous, very, very, very dangerous. And this is the exact reason why these governments have decided to throw this bone to try to distract their own populations by talking about supposedly acknowledging Palestine as a state in September, only if it's disarmed and surrenders literally to its killers, which is not going to happen. And so it's just another waste of time, try to waste the attention and the pressure release from the population. But I believe nobody has in the West, and these populations have fallen for this ridiculous ploy.
I think the lesson to be learned from Syria is that it doesn't matter if they disarm Hamas and Hezbollah, Israel would attack them even harder. And Syria just shows us what would be the future. You know, the government in Syria is trying to do everything to accommodate, to somehow cooperate with the government in Israel, but they're not satisfied with that. They want to destroy Syria. They want to capture a big chunk of Syria in the southern part of Syria. It is the case in the West Bank, in Gaza, in Lebanon, and I literally don't see Hezbollah disarming or Hamas. They totally understand better than anyone on this planet how crucial is the arm in their hands.
And yeah, you know, in Syria, you know, I know a lot of people that didn't read history or didn't read military strategies and sciences couldn't understand Syria prior to this collapse. I didn't understand the importance of it and the importance of the Syrian military. But if you take a look at the Israeli military assessments over the last 50 years, specifically after the Camp David treaty between Egypt and the Zionist colony that led to the exit of the largest Arab military from the conflict, since that point on, all Israeli politicians, leaders, and tacticians and military leaders said that their biggest threat to the existence of the Zionist colony was the Syrian military, because the Syrian military was permanently deployed in huge numbers in defensive lines on the southern border of Syria with the Zionist colony. And Syria saw only Israel as its enemy, didn't enter any wars with anybody but the Zionist colony, and had built all its capabilities and layers of its defense lines and offensive power all directed towards one enemy. And you know, there is no other Arabic military that could have confronted the Zionist colony. The Iraqi army is very far, needs to cross thousands of kilometers to get to the border. The Egyptian army is deployed inside Egypt, not allowed to be deployed in Sinai. So again, it needs thousands of kilometers to get to the border of Palestine. So the only threat was the Syrian military. And for the first time, with the collapse of the Assad government, the Israelis went buck wild crazy and destroyed 50 years of military capabilities, design and structures. And those Wahhabi death squads that took over Syria, that supposedly were claiming that the Syrian government and military are the ones that are defending Israel, sat on the side and watched all those capabilities being destroyed and let the Israeli military easily occupy the south of Syria, and is not even firing one bullet on Israeli soldiers that are violating Syrian territory and kidnapping civilians. By the way, there's been hundreds of Syrian civilians from the south of Syria that have been kidnapped by the Zionist military, and nobody knows about their future, and nobody's asking about where they are and what's happening to them, because the Wahhabi death squads in Damascus apparently don't care about their civilians. They're killing them themselves. So what if Israel kills a little bit more? So I think the Arabic liberation struggle has lost a huge pillar to that struggle with the destruction of the Syrian military. And any future Syrian resistance to Israeli occupation and colonialism will have to act as if it's a militia, and it cannot depend on those strategic power that the Syrian military had before.
Thank you so much, Leith, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Nima. See you next week, inshallah.
See you soon. Bye-bye.